literally, we're gonna speak about every person, and the constant refrain you're gonna hear from us is they had an amazing voice.
Everyone sounded so good.
No flops. Beautiful. Emotional. Gorgeous.
If you were a fan of Roy Orbison and you were looking to hear some of the best vocals on these songs, run.
Like, don't get me wrong, I think people should see it.
Hi everyone, welcome back to Off to Broadway, the podcast where we deep dive into anything and everything musical theater from the comfort of my car. I'm Tara.
I'm Stefania.
And in today's episode, we're talking about the North American premiere of In Dreams. A new musical, as it says on the program.
It does say that. And it was new.
And also, happy new season, because we are officially in the new season, the 2023-2024 season. As you heard in our last episode, it was the preview, and now we are here. We are in it. We are living it.
Preview's over. It's happening.
Yes. Full disclosure, we were gifted these tickets to see this show, but as always, the reviews are always our own opinions, our own thoughts, and we will be talking about this brand new show today. But we were at opening day, because it was a Sunday matinee.
A matinee opening. You know, I don't think it works for all shows, but for some shows, a matinee opening, you walk out to the daylight, you go home, you eat a lovely dinner. Love it.
Yeah. No, I agree. Where should we start with this? I guess we should start with, like, the premise of this musical, which I'm like, can I even give a quick synopsis? I think the, like, quickest of quick synopsis is that this story centers around Kenna, who was in a band. Now, we'll get back to, like, the band aspect later, because I do think this is a storyline. Yes, Heartbreak Radio. But I do think that the band storyline was, like, a little bit underdeveloped, and I wish that we got more of the band, but we'll get to that later. But she was in a band called Heartbreak Radio, and she receives a phone call that she has cancer, and she, I don't think, knows how long she has, but is just predicting that she doesn't have that much time.
And she's spiraling from this.
Yes, exactly. And ends up at a Mexican restaurant in what we just read is, like, Southwest USA. There's not really, like, an actual place, but just think of that when you think of where this restaurant is.
And when she calls everyone, they're able to get there quite quickly.
Immediately. So. Yeah. So everyone lives, I'm assuming it's, like, a small town, based on the fact that everyone is able to, like, drop everything and just
show up. I'm picturing, like, a desert highway, like, off a desert highway exit is what I'm picturing.
And she throws herself a memorial, because this restaurant, like, is one a restaurant, but also specializes in, like, funeral services.
Specifically Mexican funeral celebration of life memorials.
Yes. Like the Day of the Dead, like, think of that sort of thing. And that's really, like, where we have this story, is it takes place, like, the day or two or three leading up to this farewell celebration of life, and then the celebration of life, and then kind of, like, a day or two or three after. And we do have, like, a few side stories. The people that work and own the Mexican restaurant, we have Oscar and his wife, Nicole, and then also the grandmother, Anna Sophia. They're kind of our, like, main side characters, along with the other members of Heartbreak Radio. Right. That's, like, really what the show is in a gist. And to cap it off, this is a jukebox musical that is set to the music of Roy Orbison. So I would say that, like, Kenna is, if you're thinking about, like, no, this is not a bio musical, no, this is not really, like, traditional jukebox musical, this kind of leads itself to, like, the Mamma Mia fantasy world, the Anne Juliet fantasy world, of that, like, Kenna is the vehicle to the Roy Orbison songs, because she is the lead singer of this band. But then also we hear these songs as, like, internal thoughts / monologues. So it's a little gray in the jukebox
Some of the songs are performed by the characters, and everyone's aware of them being performed. And some of them are, you know, some of them are diegetic, and some of them are non-diegetic, if you will.
Yes. But it is kind of interesting, because I think, as we've talked about before, like, the jukebox genre is kind of gray. So that's why it, like, fits in this sense. And then to speak on Anne Juliet, this is David West Reed and Luke Shepherd's like follow up to Anne Juliet. They love a jukebox, as it seems. They love a jukebox.
So yeah, David West Reed wrote the book to Anne Juliet, which we absolutely loved. Thought it used the songs so well, thought it captured the tone so well, thought it was a really creative use of those songs and putting them together and putting together a really fun story that wasn't too heavy-handed in any way. And Luke Shepherd directed that production. The direction of Anne Juliet, I think, is fine.
Agree.
Like nothing, like, super exciting, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But good. Nothing wrong with it. So when we saw David West Reed's, we're like, oh, he's really good at, David West Reed's name on this, we thought, oh, he's really good at adapting songs from an artist to a brand new story, creating the story, because this is an original story that I believe it says in the program he wrote, or he came up with. So it was kind of like, oh, let's see what he does next. Let's see what he has up his sleeve for this catalog of songs.
And what are your overall thoughts on this show?
I think I have a lot of thoughts. First, what I have to say is I think there are a lot of reasons to see this show and a lot of reasons to recommend this show. I would definitely recommend it to a lot of people because I think there's so much going for it. But what I will say is I don't think lightning struck twice for David West Reed in an adaptation here.
I mean,
I don't think this quite worked as well.
The Toronto Star article, that is the first sentence of the review. Lightning never strikes twice. And that's unfortunately true for David West Reed and Luke Shepherd. So congratulations on pulling that headline just out of your head.
I
agree. I do think that this show is for a very specific audience, which I think is already hard when you're doing a jukebox. And there's already a built-in audience of people that hate jukebox musicals. So it's definitely difficult. I do want to read, there was an article in the Star before the show came out where they spoke with David West Reed and Luke Shepherd. And he did specifically talk about the jukebox musical style. And he said, people somehow think it's easier or that it's less work involved than with an original musical. To me, it's actually like you're starting with far more obstacles and challenges, pieces of the puzzle that already exist that you have to fit together as opposed to open wide canvas. And yes. I think that that's actually really important because, again, as I said, a lot of people just have that blanket statement of I hate jukebox because it's just, you know, the songs, as he said, are already built in. So it must be easy to just craft things around it. But unless you're doing a bio musical, it's actually not easy to craft things around built-in songs. You can't really change the lyrics. You're kind of like stuck within that, within the parameters of the music that you're given. The really only thing that you can do is like change how it's orchestrated. We've seen this with Jagged Little Pill.
Like
we've seen this with
Anne
Juliet. Yeah. So it's just like, I do feel for anybody that works on a jukebox musical because I actually think it's very hard to do this.
I agree. It's like you sometimes are fitting, you know, a square peg into a round hole in a jukebox musical when you're putting it together.
Yeah.
You're kind of mashing these pieces and folding them and squishing them together, but it doesn't always look seamless at the end. And some look much more seamless than others.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this one I do think you're seeing cracks a little bit. My number one thing, I guess at intermission, was why are we telling this story so much about Mexican culture and Mexican traditions with the music of Roy Orbison? That was one confusion of mine. What are your thoughts on that?
I 100% agree. We were wondering all the way through what the connection was here for David West Reed. I do know, again, just from reading like quite a bit about this show, we did mention this in our last episode, but to mention it again, this did have a run at Leeds Playhouse in the UK prior to this Toronto North American premiere. And what we still believe, although after seeing it, I don't know how this is going to happen, but I do believe they are still hoping for Broadway. It's kind of the same sort of thing of like Betsy Wolf and Stark Sands were here, and now we have Lena Hall and Oliver Thompson here as well, which we will get to performances in a second because truly the strongest part of this show. But back to the Day of the Dead, I know that a lot of research went into this. I know that he said that they worked with the woman that plays Nicole, Gabriella Garcia. Is this the same person that played in Toronto? I believe.
Is it? Because I think she's from Canada, the girl who played it in Toronto.
Then no. So the original person that played Nicole, Gabriella Garcia, who's the girlfriend of the restaurant owner, he worked a lot with her to talk about, like, how to properly talk about the Day of the Dead. It says here that she saw this as an opportunity to express herself and see herself represented. She helped me with a dialogue and a lot of the cultural elements that are the central to the show. Which I love that we are getting authentic representation. I just don't love that David West Reed's name is the writer on this for authentic representation. I'm all for, like, reaching out to get help and stuff, but it would be, I just, like, at the end of the day, it's his name, not hers. You know what I mean?
Yes, I was reading the program, and I don't think it's quite clear on the process of how this musical came to be. They said, basically, David West Reed and Luke Shepherd had worked together previously, wanted to work together again, and then it said the opportunity arose to explore Roy Orbison's music in a theatrical setting. I'm not quite sure what that means, if Roy Orbison's team reached out to them, the estate reached out to them to say, you want to write a musical? Is that what you think happened?
No, so I don't know exactly what happened, but I do know, again, based on this Toronto Star article pre the show being out, Luke Shepherd had been involved in a Roy Orbison workshop musical that was not this previously.
Oh.
So he had already dabbled in the world of Roy Orbison before he even met David West Reed for Anne Juliet. So that is a weird coincidence, I guess. And then that show didn't pan out. Then they obviously met, Anne Juliet came out, and then David West Reed told him that Roy Orbison's music catalog was one that he had always wanted to work with. And then they kind of, like, put their heads together from this, like, oh, me, Luke Shepherd, wanted to do this originally. Me, David West Reed, also wanted to do this. Let's put our heads together and come up with this. However, again, I don't quite get it for the storyline that we got.
Yes.
I do think that there are moments that definitely work in this musical, that it do feel like the David West Reed and Juliet style of this song fits well into this scene. I'm thinking of, like, I Drove All Night. I thought that that was a standout because it kind of works.
You were saying this and I agree. He's really good at writing the scene into the song. It rarely feels clunky.
Agreed.
When the scene transitions to a song. That's one of the hardest parts of musicals, where people are just talking to each other and they all of a sudden start singing. And it always feels awkward, and I find he's good at it, making it not feel awkward. Maybe that's part of direction as well, but I'm giving credit to David West Reed on this.
Yeah.
And transitioning and song placement.
But again, to what we were just saying, I just don't really understand the premise, like, why they settled on this specifically. And there are moments that, like, yes, were really great leading into these songs, but then there were moments that it was like, oh, you're just singing this song because it's a Roy Orbison song, and we need to
put in this
musical.
These are ones that we need to have here.
Yeah.
Yes. To me, it felt they had this beautiful catalog of music, and they had this beautiful story that they wanted to tell, and then they're like, oh, let's do them at the same time. Like, I don't know if the story didn't feel like it organically came from these songs.
No.
In a way that I want them to. And again, you could say that for Anne Juliet, that did that story organically come from those songs?
But there's,
I don't know. But it felt different.
I honestly think that the reason, and we will be comparing these two a lot because it's obviously like the same writers, the same creative team.
Yeah.
To me, the reason that feels so different, that one is almost like fantasy. This feels more like real life.
Yes.
And
this one
that's
is more grounded
why
in realism than Anne Juliet was.
Yes.
For sure.
So I can forgive the moments when songs don't quite work in Anne Juliet because it's straight fantasy to me. Whereas in this, I'm like, this feels parody instead of real life.
And Anne Juliet has a more, this is not the right word, but a cornier tone in general.
Yes. Yes.
Right. Intentionally, like, a little exaggerated.
Totally.
Whereas these characters are meant to be human beings living on Earth, operating in the real, in like a real scenario and relating to each other in a real way.
The other thing that was, like, slightly confusing to us is that they do bring up Coco in this show, like, a couple times. And it so was like...
this is modern.
Well, but is it also, like, is that what... Like, did David Westreed love Coco? And, like,
maybe
was, like...
David Westreed is the one who loved Coco.
And don't get me wrong, because we'll talk about this in a bit, too, about the set. Like, the premise of a, like, Mexican tradition Day of the Dead is... beautiful. Like, the it's very beautiful to look at. I just don't quite understand it for the premise of this specific musical.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know. I would be interested to hear about the creative process, about how they came to this story, what the inspiration was for this story. Outside of just, I can understand how they would have come to a story of a band that has been apart, one of the members gets sick and brings the other members back together. That seems reasonable to me, but where did we get, and then they fall into a Mexican restaurant and have a memorial following Mexican traditions while she's still alive?
Yes.
Where did we get that element of the story? Yeah, it just didn't all hang together in the way that I would want it to. But...
let's talk about some of the good. As I had just mentioned, the set. I loved what they did with the set to a certain point, and I think I had the exact same critique for Anne Juliet, so I do think that this might be a David Westreed, Luke Shepherd kind of thing.
Maybe Luke Shepherd loves this.
Maybe. But they love a projection, and I hate a projection, but I do think there were moments when the projection worked extremely well.
The projection was so good in this.
Well, so let's talk about the, there was a scene towards the end which took place outside of the restaurant where they bring down, like, the physical sign of the restaurant.
Let's go even further back. So for most of Act 1, you're in the restaurant. That's where it takes place, right?
Yeah.
And so you have physical set for most of the, for most of Act 1 and a lot of Act 2, but the ceiling just has kind of beams and you're seeing the back through the beams. And the back is projection or a screen, and it's showing the night sky through these beams, and it looks beautiful, in my opinion.
No, and I agree.
And they have the, like, electrical wires in the back.
That was what I was going to say. That was my favorite part, because you have the physical realism of the pole of the electrical wire, but the wires are going into the projection. I was like, this is really smart.
The wires were never real. They were just projected the whole time.
But the way that it was, like, the optical illusion was so well done that I think anyone who is looking to do sort of that going forward should take a note from this musical, because they did it right. I do want to shout out the set designer. Sure. Arnulfo. Oh, Steph, you might have to come in here with a pronouncer.
Pronunciation moment.
Maldonado?
I would say Arnulfo Maldonado. Arnulfo Maldonado.
So
do you have a lighting person as well, I wonder?
I'm sure it's
lighting designer somewhere. Howard Hudson.
Great.
Video designer George Reeve.
Oh, a video, great.
Video designer.
So agree, and also then, like, the colorization of the restaurant was really well done. Anytime that we were celebrating, like, the Day of the Dead, like, really felt authentic to, like, a Mexican restaurant, which I thought was really great. All was good until we got to, like, the very end of Act 2, and then we start having, I don't even know, like, shooting star.
This is the moment that was, like, magical realism a little bit.
But, like, it was so literal that this is how I felt about, like, the carousel in Anne Juliet. The, I can't even remember what else was in Anne Juliet that I was like, oh, this is a little too on the nose for me, and I've been suspending my disbelief until I'm no longer suspending disbelief.
Yeah, yes, I agree. That moment where I think it's the character of Oscar, who is, he's singing an emotional song.
He's singing In Dreams.
He's singing In Dreams.
The title song.
The title song. Or is he?
Yes, he definitely is. Yeah.
Okay, he is, whatever. Beautiful, he's singing about his parents, he's kind of sitting alone. The restaurant set is gone, so it's really just the back, the stage is wide open, you're just open, wide open sky at this point. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it starts swirling. Stars start swirling. And you're like, oh no.
I said it out loud.
Because it had been so beautiful up until that point.
Yeah, because I think it was like, it was literally like maybe 5 minutes before that I had leaned over to tell you how much I loved the electrical wires. And then the next thing that we see is this rolling star movement.
No, what I loved so much about it, like what I was saying, is that the screen and the projection and the video on there was incorporated into the physical set, and it was an extension and it enhanced the physical set.
Yes.
In that moment. I think that's like kind of the best way to use it, is when you have a physical set and then you are enhancing it through this beautiful screen. But when you're on this, and then when the sun was setting at a later song, like this huge sun, and then they like walk all into the sunset at the end, I'm like, this is actually beautiful too. I like this. This is sweet.
It's a little cheesy, but
that's okay. The whole thing was cheesy. Like, they actually, not in a bad way, but
they actually did something very similar in New York, New York, when I saw it on Broadway. They do that, you know, you've definitely heard of this. There's a specific place that you can be in New York when the sun sets in between two buildings. It happens like twice a year or something like that. Wow. And they used that scene, but the sunset was projection. So that felt very similar to that.
That's beautiful.
Also, randomly, and I don't know that they needed it, there was a turntable on this stage.
But, like, off to the side. It was an off-to-the-side turntable.
I don't think it was used as effectively as it was, obviously, in Anne Juliet, where I was truly obsessed with the character of the turntable in that show. But in this, it was just kind of used to move people around, which I guess is really what the use of it is, but yeah.
I know. There used to be a time... I sound like, you know, old. In my day, you know, you only put a turntable in if you really needed it. Now I feel like every show's got a turntable.
Oh,
it's
for
like
sure.
Every show we're
as soon as everyone figures out that like the Ed Mervish Theater is rigged for a turntable, they're like, gotta use it.
No, I think they brought that in.
I'm sure they did. Turntable. But yeah, I also, this is an argument that I think I could make for a lot of shows, but I don't think the show needed to be at the Ed Mervish. It's just so big. Oh, no. Like, that is the first time we've been in there since Cursed Child, though. So for anyone wondering, the center aisle still exists.
Still there.
And I do think that they might keep it for the foreseeable
future.
Well,
they spent a lot of money on those renovations. They're not going to re-renovate.
Yes. And we were also inspecting, but the boxes are still fake, so there are no seats in the boxes.
And it kind of, like, narrowed the house, in my opinion. Like, and I think there are false boxes in front of the real boxes that are still behind, in my opinion.
And then you think, we weren't up there, but you think that the mezzanine is still shortened from what it used to be.
Yes. When I sat for Cursed Child, I sat in the balcony, and Ed Mervish doesn't have two, it's just, like, one big giant one.
Yeah.
And when I was up there for Cursed Child, I'm like, it's smaller. They've like closed it in a bit. And when you talk to one of the ushers, my mom asked the usher, and he's like, I've been here for 30 years. And he's like, yes, there are seats back there. And I don't think they've opened it up again. I think they've left that like false wall still there. Right. So yeah, if you're in there, the seats are basically essentially exactly the same as they were for Cursed Child.
Yeah,
so I think it seats somewhere like 1,600 people, something like that.
It's the biggest theater in Toronto.
Yeah.
Or a Mervish Theater in Toronto. So, I don't know. I don't think it, like, it doesn't hurt it, but it also doesn't benefit from being in a big theater. It could have been in the other two theaters. They're just busy right now. So,
yeah.
That's my only thought on that.
It says, with a two-tiered auditorium that was completely renovated in 2021 and 2022, and with two seating configurations, 1,600 and 2,000 seats. So interesting.
Set aside, something else that I want to go back to with like story, which I think was something that we were wondering with like an Anne Juliet. We're also kind of always wondering this when shows come from the UK, and that's like the tone and the jokes of the show.
Yeah.
So yeah. Luke Shepherd did say in a Globe and Mail article that they were fine tuning the humor and the tone in the in-between process. He said that there have been little tweaks to the story, beats that we think could be cleaner, nuances to add detail. We did the same thing with Anne Juliet when we came to Toronto from London. We hold each other to a very high standard. We're always striving to make something a bit better each time. So I wonder if like certain jokes hit better in the UK than they did here. I didn't think that this was like a particularly like overly funny show. It had like its comedic moments, but nothing that like struck me as like, oh, that's from the UK humor. I didn't get that vibe in this.
Well, because the characters are all American too. It's interesting that it's from the UK because it seems like a very American story.
Right.
Roy Orbison himself, was born in Texas, like, did, like, American-style music. So it is interesting. And also, like, Luke Shepherd is British, but David West Reed is Canadian, obviously.
Right.
So it's very interesting that it originated in the UK and has so many British actors starring in it doing these American accents in the show.
So that kind of leads to the next point, which is performances.
Yes, absolutely.
And talking about the one person who is keeping their British accent, Oliver Thompson. We obviously are familiar with him from his Anne Juliet days.
He played
Shakespeare in the West End. He played it for quite a long time, like pre-pandemic, post-pandemic, during pandemic,
originated
all of that.
It.
Originated. He's on the cast album from the West End. I think he has a wonderful voice. I think he is such a fantastic singer. I did see on his Instagram that he did not audition for this show. It was offer only. They asked him based on their collaboration with him previously and thought that this would be a good fit for him. He also admitted that he was not super familiar with Roy Orbison, so I think that that's kind of funny. To me, I mentioned it a bit earlier, but his standout performance was We Drove All Night. He was so good in that. He sounded amazing in that. And it was nice to see him after watching him on YouTube for many years.
In person. I agree. He had a beautiful, literally, we're going to speak about every person, and the constant refrain you're going to hear from us is they had an amazing voice.
Everyone sounded so good.
No flops vocally. No, really. Everyone sounded so good.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll get to our star in a second, but yeah, Oliver Thompson, I was like, show us what you got.
No, it was great. Yeah.
And he sounded great. Speaking of I Drove All Night, I loved the staging of that. That was so fun with the, they made the parts of the car with items from around the restaurant, like a measuring cup or like a serving tray as like the rear view mirror or the steering wheel and holding it around. I thought that was really fun.
Agreed.
And he sounded great on that. Anytime he sang, he sounded great. He's so tall. I was so like, how tall is he?
Yeah.
And
he's
got to
be like six something. But that's also where I am kind of a little confused and feel like the story was a little underwritten, because like, where did he come from? Like, what is the origin of this band that they have this one British member? Like, where did we meet him? So
yeah,
I almost wish we got more of like the earlier days of Heartbreak Radio. We have like two characters that are kind of playing like super fans, one more than the other, who's like a bigger star, who was also, what a great voice, played the character of Tom. His name is Leon Craig. Has like a show-stopping performance at the beginning of Act Two, singing.
Sorry, a quick interruption. A 2011 article says that Oliver Thompson is 6'3".
Wow. Thank you so much for that.
You're welcome. You're welcome for that. Anyway, go on.
But yeah, he opens Act Two singing Heartbreak Radio, which was a standout for this character. But yeah, like these two characters are talking about how much they love this band. And I'm like, but I know nothing about the band. Like, why do you love them so much? I just wanted to know more about the band in general.
Yes, they're talking about how much they miss each other. They haven't seen each other in a long time. And it's like, well, what's the history? Why are you a family? Like,
yes.
It's not enough to just be like, we were in a band together. Okay, lots of people are in a band and hate each other. Okay?
Right. So,
like,
in that sense,
why?
It kind of feels like a getting the band back together story, but, like, not really, because what is the band? I wanted more. I just wanted more about them. I wanted a, like, flashback scene of them performing. We only get them performing as a band at the very, very end. Yeah, we're going to save our star till the very end, but please tell us your favorite singer in this show who played Donovan.
My favorite singer, Noel Sullivan, playing Donovan. Also a member of the band. Donovan and Jane are members of the band who are married and now have 5 kids. So they see each other all the time. I don't remember what he was singing, but I was like, wow, his voice.
She was great too. I believe it's Sean, right?
S-I-A-N.
Sean Reese Williams. Again, like, as we said, everyone, vocals were being served. Like, that was not an issue at all.
I want to say they were singing.
Like, she's a mystery. Maybe it was Handle with Care. It might have been Handle with Care.
Maybe it was Handle with Care. It was like they were both singing on like separate sides of the stage, kind of like lamenting the like connection in their marriage that maybe they've lost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, five kids, years together, you get in a little rut. It might have been like Handle With Care. Or no, it wasn't Handle With Care. Handle With Care is like the bop.
Handle With Care is the fake Act One finale.
Yeah. I think it was A Love So Beautiful.
Okay, probably. Yeah.
I think it was Love So Beautiful. Handle With Care was the fake Act One finale where we're like, oh, amazing. Two more songs.
Yeah.
After that, we're like, oh.
Yeah. That's also a little, I think, a little messy there. Act One felt quite long. Act Two was shorter, but then also felt long. So, yeah. I don't know. Then to get to our restaurant crew, we have Manuel Pacific and Nassim Ramirez playing Oscar and Nicole. And then we also have Alma Cuervo playing...
Cuervo?
Playing Anna Sophia. Again, like, I don't know that they had a lot to do, but then they also had, like... Oscar had had too much to do at some point.
Oscar and Nicole had a lot to do.
They had a lot to do, but they... Yes, but also their story was a little underdeveloped. I just feel like, in general, the story was underdeveloped, so it's hard to... It's hard to feel for these characters when you can't... When you don't know enough about them to, like... empathize. You know what I mean? Like, Oscar's having a hard time with his family, but we don't figure out any of this until the literally second last song of the show.
Yes, I do find it inauthentic sometimes when characters... So Oscar, like, lost his parents, and that's why he does these memorial services at his restaurant, because he wasn't given the opportunity to truly, like, remember and memorialize his parents in the way he wanted to, so he wants to give other families that opportunity. But people keep going to him like, your family, your parents would be so proud of you. And I'm like, who are his parents? Who are they to me? Like, how is that supposed to have emotional meaning to me? Like,
no, I know.
I don't know if that's like saying your parents would be so proud of you is like an emotional shortcut to feelings, but I don't know. I don't know his parents. They haven't been introduced to us because they've been deceased. It's a side story, so it's not even like we're focusing on this character. So then we're just getting, you know, this kind of like side secondary story about his parents, and I don't know if like it really like hit home enough to deserve this like kind of 11 o'clock emotional number. Him and his wife are not like seeing eye to eye, they're not communicating, and I'm like, I don't know if we
understand
this.
I agree. To me, I would get rid of the 11 o'clock number. I would also chop a lot of this storyline.
I think what I would do... The focus needs to be narrowed. But for this storyline, so the character of Nicole is pregnant. I think I would have just had his storyline be... I know this is like a story that we see over and over again. I think I would have had his storyline be, because he lost his parents so young, being nervous to become a parent. I think that would have like been a little more like of a narrowed focus and easier to understand, and also like not be centered on characters that we've never met and will never meet, but be centered on more him. I think that could have like just like been a little clearer to the audience.
I agree, because the other confusing thing is that Anna Sophia is his grandmother, but we never really see the two of them speak. And she would know about his parents' death because one of his parents would be her child. But we never get into that. So we like, we start the appetizer, we dig into the main course, and then we throw the dessert away. So like, that's kind of where I land with like this storyline. And then also she has a love interest for like a hot second in the character George, played by Richard Trinder, who sings the most iconic, most memorable, known Roy Orbison song.
This character is literally there to sing Pretty Woman.
It's actually Oh Pretty Woman.
Oh Pretty Woman. I think his character is literally there for the purpose of singing Oh Pretty Woman.
And was a crowd pleaser.
Yes.
But then I'm also like, did we need this? I didn't think that we needed... I mean, we needed the song, obviously. I just don't know that we needed him to talk about...
This man lost his wife 3 months ago, and he's looking for love again.
Sure. And
my husband...
His second wife, Steph. Yeah.
If my husband, even if I'm a second wife, 3 months after I die, is like hitting up a restaurant employee for romance, I'd be like, excuse me. I'd be dead. But, well, I'd be like, excuse me.
Well, she also was, like, hesitant at first because she made this whole beautiful speech of how she'll meet her husband again and that she doesn't want to, like, see anybody else. And then by the end of this musical, she's, like, flirting with this man. So, and it really takes place over, like, 3 days. So, I don't know. Confusing. Confusing. But let's talk about the star of this show, playing Kenna. We talked about her in our previous episode and how excited we were to see her in Toronto. Lena Hall, everybody. And damn vocals.
So good. So good. I mean, I think specifically, many times, but I think specifically in the song Crying at the end of Act One, that Act One finale, it's just really her singing by herself. Beautiful. Emotional. Gorgeous.
And from this moment on, I'll be crying, 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 yeah, crying, crying, oh, boy, oh.
She has a tone that I don't think any other musical theater actor has. She is a rock star in, like, capital R all the way to the end of that. And I've seen her on stage before as Yitzhak in Hedwig and the Angry Inch, but that was, like, a very long time ago. So to see that she's, like, still got it and still sounds... She's so good. Even, like, the way that she opens the show, she's kind of, like, at a mic with a guitar. She's speaking directly to the audience, and she is wailing. And it's just, like, it is so good. There's a couple videos online. They have Anything You Want. Is that what it is? Anything You Got? Whatever that song
is called.
Anything
I Want. I think so.
You got it. You got it. Is the title of the song. They have that on YouTube, and there is a moment in that, like, music video that they filmed that, like, Oliver Thompson is just, like, watching her and the way that she's singing. And you know when you make, like, the stink face when someone sounds good? He's doing it the whole time because it's just, like, you can't believe the vocals that are coming out of this woman. She is so, like, small but has such a big... huge vocal range, and it's very impressive to see live.
Yeah, I wonder, you watch her sing and you're like, where does this come from? Where is this voice coming from? Because it's outrageous. It's so good.
Yeah. There is also a Crying is online as well. I'll put a little snippet in this episode, but those two I think are her, like, biggest moments in the show. And then we also have, like, random side characters who I couldn't tell you anything about them, and two of them are potentially...
My favorite side characters.
The waiters.
The waiters. They're just in, like, a blue polo and khaki shorts. They have zero lines. They do nothing.
And then the police
officer. The police
officer.
They're just kind of there, like, filling out the ensemble. I'm like, I can't believe you're here doing this show. That would be my ideal role in a musical, to be honest. Like, waiter at restaurant in musical... No speaking, just singing, like, ensemble harmony.
They must also be understudies, no?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, well.
I believe they are.
Yeah.
I believe they are.
So, I don't know. I think at the end of the day, like you said, I do think that there is, like, specifically an audience. I actually do want to read the final review from the Globe and Mail saying... having served up a sing-along for Millennial and Generation Z audience with Anne Juliet, their jukebox musical of Max Martin pop hits, which played Toronto last year en route to Broadway, Reed and Shepherd have now gone after the Boomers and the Gen Xers. And I agree.
Absolutely. Like, Roy Orbison's was making music in the 60s, and there definitely is a generation that would be, that, like, this is the music that they grew up with. And would be really excited by hearing this music. And for us, there were only a few songs that we had heard before. So that's, like, kind of our deficit going into it, not having that emotional connection to the songs the way we did with something like In Juliet, where every song is a song that was played constantly on the radio during our childhood.
Yeah.
These are songs that were played on the radio during the target audience of this musical's childhood. We were surrounded by people who absolutely loved the show. We saw it with your parents at the same time. They had a great time at the show. And I think I would really recommend it to like this demographic, because with that connection to the music, like, you'll never find this music better sung anywhere else, in my opinion.
That's the thing. Like, my parents walked down to us at intermission and were like, this is great, which obviously we had a bit of differing opinions at that time.
Yeah.
But then as we were on the way home, my dad was like, I knew every single song that was coming up as soon as it is that feeling of, like, again, with Anne Juliet, with like a Moulin Rouge, when you sit in the theater, you're like, I know this.
Yes.
I couldn't have that same connection because, as you said, I only knew, like, a couple songs.
For us, it might as well have been an original musical.
Totally.
With, like, brand new music.
Totally.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, that's how we were kind of approaching it, whereas your parents or the audience members surrounding us, like, who were having an amazing time, they were seeing it in a very different way.
Yeah.
And I think that... like, what you bring to it does make your experience different. So which I think has absolutely impacted our review today, that these are not songs that we're super, super familiar with or grew up with or have that emotional connection to.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on the potential transfer of this show?
Okay. Having said that, I do believe there is a big audience for this show. I think my parents would enjoy it. Family friends who I know are subscribers as well will enjoy it. I do not believe it will be successful on Broadway.
I agree, and I want to say for all reasons that we've stated, but I actually think the main reason for this is we've talked about this many, many times of shows on Broadway. What does In Dreams mean to you? What does it mean when I say this is a Roy Orbison jukebox musical? It does not have the same tourist appeal of Back to the Future, Moulin Rouge, The Lion King. Like, it just means nothing from a tourist point of view. And I think it would be actually quite difficult to sell tickets to this show.
The marketing, for sure. Well, when I was describing it actually to, I was telling, my mom, I was going to, we're seeing In Dreams. It's a Roy Orbison jukebox musical. She thought it was a bio musical.
So did my dad.
And then I was trying to explain, no, it's an original story, just using the songs. So it's not giving, you know, everyone singing Sweet Caroline at the end of A Beautiful Noise. You know what I mean? It's not. It's really not.
It's not.
They should sing Pretty Woman at the end. I really think they should.
Well, they sing You Got It again, which had the crowd kind of on their feet, but also we weren't sure if we should be on our feet. It was a confusing.
Well, they did. Well, okay, so this is actually, so because we were at media performance, they did their like song, Wild Hearts Run Out of Time, I think. Was it that one? Where the band played? Or no, was it You Got It that the band played?
I think it was You Got It, yeah.
Where they were like, Heartbreak Hotel. And,
Kenna's
like, we're Heartbreak Hotel. So people started to get up and stand and clap along. No bows have happened yet, including David Mirbish himself getting up to clap along. But then the curtains close, they walk into the sunset, and then the bows start after. So people sat down again.
I think this is your, like, your
move
main...
Move the bows up!
Yeah, this is your main critique all the time. You gotta move the bows up so that the crowd is standing for...
And then it's like, stay on
moment.
Your feet! Let's go one more song! And then it's like, we are Heartbreak Radio!
They should take a note from over on King Street, what's happening at 6, when you bow, and then they say, let's do the
Make
It 6.
You have one more song? Like, yes. Do you got time for one more song?
They should
then I think it's like... Yeah, she'd be like, we're Heartbreak Radio. And then, you know, have the rest of the cast, like, jumping up and down like fangirls, you know, like...
Agree.
Like, the crowd, or pumping up the crowd or something.
Yeah. Agree.
I think that would make it, like, really fun. Everyone would be on their feet. And then you'd walk out, like, feeling like $1 million because you're like, that was so much fun.
Yeah, like, think of if anyone has ever seen Mamma Mia, you stand up there for the Megamix, you leave the theater having a grand old time, even if Mamma Mia is also kind of... Not the best show you've ever seen, you know what I mean?
Mamma Mia leans into the camp, okay? Mamma Mia leans in. And I don't know if this show is leaning in.
The one thing I will say is that if they are eyeing Broadway, I do think that they're probably serving this, as we've talked about before, as their out-of-town tryout. But I do think this needs work. I do think this needs some rewrites. I do think we need to think about this show in a different way to know if it will hit New York audiences. It's a thing of, like, as I just spoke on name recognition, but unfortunately David West Reed is not a name at this current stage in the game. Yes, he had a super smash hit with Anne Juliet, but, like, that's it. I don't know him from, like, previous other works that I am running to see. This is the only other thing. So I don't think his name is enough recognition. We've talked about this before, specifically when Anjuliette was here. They really, really leaned into the marketing of, like, the writer of Schitt's Creek. And it's like, no, he's only one of the writers of Schitt's Creek.
He was in the writer's room.
Yeah, so I don't think that that marketing stance will make a difference this time around.
I don't think that's how they marketed it in New York. I don't think they were like, Anjuliette? A writer from Schitt's Creek. Yeah.
No, but every radio ad, every commercial I saw here. But that's probably because, like, it's a Canadian, Schitt's Creek was a Canadian production. Two Schitt's Creek cast members at the In Dreams opening.
Yeah, we did. We did see.
Yes.
One last thing. I said this to you at the show, and this is a show I haven't seen, but I turned to you and I said, this show is giving Escape to Margaritaville. And
then we got the song, Margarita.
Margarita. There were a lot of, like, neon signs, which the I love the neon signs. Like, what the, like, when the curtain was down before the show started with the In Dreams neon sign.
Gorgeous. Beautiful. Gorgeous. Beautiful. Yeah.
All the neon signs in the restaurant, like, so good. Such great set deck. The neon sign for the sign outside that came down sometimes. Beautiful. Like, really.
You know who else has a really good sign? Margaritaville.
Margaritaville.
Yeah, we've never seen Escape to Margaritaville, but, like, it's just a vibe, it's just a feeling, so yeah. I agree. I did think it was interesting, before we rate this and move on to Obsession, I did think it's interesting, I was reading, Luke Shepherd's next project to direct is the revival of Starlight Express in the UK.
Love that for him.
This is the roller skating musical, right?
Yes, they're like trains.
You know, he loves a splash. He loves a big big lighting moment.
He does love a splash. He does love a splash. Yeah. You know, I will say, I know we're going to get to ratings. I think there are a lot of reasons to recommend this show. I really do. But I didn't love it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of that.
I agree. I think it's a very specific audience. But again, if you are a fan of Roy Orbison and you are looking to hear some of the best vocals on these songs, run to see it. You'll, as you said earlier, you'll never hear these songs sung better than how it's being sung in this show. And with that, what are you rating In Dreams?
Okay. I've thought long and hard about this. And I'm going to rate it out of 10, right? I'm going to rate it 6 out of 10 neon signs.
Okay, great. I am going to give this 5 out of 10 margaritas.
Okay.
The other thing that I will say, we will be talking about this, it's very difficult when on a Thursday night you see the opening performance of 6, and then on a Sunday afternoon you see In Dreams. I will leave it at that. But that is kind of how I feel with, like, 3 days in between.
When is In Dreams running to?
Dreams is running till November 12th. Also, there is Rush available. The tickets are $39 for Rush seats.
Oh, good.
And I will say, just from, like, doing digging, because I love to see how shows are selling in Toronto, it's pretty readily available. So subscribers are, like, in the zone right now to go, probably for the first, like, 3 or so weeks. And then towards the end, there are tickets available. So, yeah, I don't not recommend it. It just wasn't my favorite thing that I saw this year.
That's the thing. I do recommend this show. I do recommend it.
Yeah.
Like, don't get me wrong. I think people should see it.
And also, when there's a discount, even more reason
to go. Absolutely.
So, we don't know that this is going to extend. I don't believe it is, because I do think that To Kill a Mockingbird is moving in, like, very soon after for their, like, 10-day run. And currently, at this time, there are no other slated productions of this show. So, we'll see what the future holds. I did see on Broadway World or one of those websites that there is a tab that says In Dreams Broadway 2024. So I do think it is on people's radar.
It's potential.
But I also think that it might rely heavily on how it does here with a North American audience versus a UK audience. It was not in the West End, so that's also something to think about. That so it could go there first.
Yeah, maybe it'll do a run actual in the West End.
Yeah. The other thing too that I'll say,
Before Broadway.
That we always say, whether we love something or don't, seeing a brand new musical is always exciting. So
100%, 100%. I love seeing new musicals. And for this season, in at Mervish, this is one of the only ones I haven't seen. So
right.
truly so exciting.
Yeah. But yeah, so that's our thoughts on this production of In Dreams. And with that, it's now time for our obsession of the week.
My obsession. So for some reason, I like thought this morning, maybe you talked about this already, but if you did, I don't care. I'm going to talk about it again. So one of my favorite ever musicals just finished, I believe today, a run in the West End.
I definitely talked about this like 3 weeks ago.
I'm taking it back again. It's mine.
Is it the same performance?
I don't remember what you talked about,
Well,
Tara.
we're about to find out. This is the real tea of these episodes. Steph doesn't listen to my
You
obsessions.
listen to me?
Yes, I listen to you. I have to edit your voice.
Hear me again. Hear me again. I'm talking about Miss Casey Levy in Next to
Yes,
Normal, okay?
obviously.
No, literally this morning I was like, this is such a good obsession. And then I'm like, Tara talked about this
It's
thing
I Miss the
too.
Mountains, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't listen to it when you put it, but because I'm behind, okay? We can talk about other things. So I watched a few clips. There's a beautiful clip of Casey Levy and Eleanor Worthington Cox singing Maybe. I don't even know where they were. It's not like an official released video from it, but they're singing Maybe, which is from the end of Next to Normal, which is beautiful. Obviously, Next to Normal is one of my favorite shows ever, and I'm excited. I mean, we've seen production here. I
Just for
saw the original.
context, it was my obsession on the Rent episode.
Okay, great. Congratulations. Okay. In the past few years, we've been lucky, not that we've seen them. Well, we saw the one that was here in Toronto in 2019, and then but there have been these really wonderful productions of Next to Normal in the US and now in the UK, starring really like high caliber actresses as Diana and as everyone else. But I'm thinking of like Rachel Bay Jones in the US and now Casey Levy in
That one was
the
Kennedy
UK,
Center,
Kennedy Center.
right? Yeah.
It's yes, I believe it was the Kennedy Center. It's so exciting to see actresses that I love, like aging into this role and getting to like really sink their teeth into this role.
I was actually gonna say, like, of the few, Casey is the youngest, I would say, like at this current time. And I think it's kind of interesting to show the depiction of mental health at different ages of women in this kind of a role because,
Well,
like,
when.
yeah, go ahead.
When you think about the story, this is something Diana and Dan met in university and got pregnant in university. So, and their children are teenagers. Like, I don't know how old Gabe would be, maybe like 18 years old. So, they're probably only around 40 at the time that the story is taking place.
Yeah.
So, I don't know how old Casey Levy is exactly, if she's like in her 30s or whatever, but I actually think like 40 is not that old. Not that like Alice Ripley was like a senior
No.
citizen or anything, but I think to show, yes, to show it younger, but also to accurately depict the age that these characters might be, is really, really beautiful.
Yeah.
And this, like, it depicts really the idea this is a mother, but also she's just kind of figuring out life at the same time as her daughter is. And I think like to have them be a little bit closer in age, which I think is more accurate to the story being told, does like add depth to the story. So I think, so you talked about I Miss the Mountains. So I was also watching Casey Levy and Eleanor Worthington Cox, who plays Natalie, sing Maybe, which is kind of, you know, a mother and daughter just trying to like tell each other how they've been feeling. It's the first time they were really able to communicate to each other. And like the casting in this case, I think really emphasizes the point that, you know, you never finish growing up or you never finish learning and you never are like 100%, you know, okay, or you're always, you know, just figuring it out. And I think Casey Levy's casting in that, like, a much younger casting than typical. Not much younger, but, like, she mm-hmm. is age-appropriate, but than we've seen before, I think really adds to that storytelling element. When I thought you might be dead, and I cried for all you never been. But there'll be no more crying.
It's also, this is now, like, I don't know how many in the last year, but whatever's going on in the UK right now, bring that over to New York, Toronto, whatever, bring that energy here. There's so many, like, immersive shows right now, and the yeah. way that this is staged from what I've seen in photos, I'm like, why aren't we doing innovative things more?
Yes.
Like, they are over in the UK. It, like, literally, when I see this stuff, I'm like, we gotta go back. Like, it's been so long since I've been to London. I'm like, this Guys and Dolls that's playing right now, that's, like, 100% immersive. Like, I don't even care about that show, but the fact that it's immersive, I feel like I need to see it. So this is just my campaign in general for more innovative staging of these shows that have already been on. When you can do a revival, let's do it up. Let's do it big.
Yes, like something a little bit different. Casey Levy is 42, in case you're wondering. I just looked it up. So perfectly age-appropriate casting. Yeah, so the Donmar Warehouse
she's also got a
has kind of like fun things.
Great, like, lob right now. Mm-hmm. Makes me want to cut my hair again. Hair. Yeah. Agree.
Yeah. Okay, Tara, what is your obsession this week?
Okay, my obsession this week is probably one that I should have used last week because it would have been more timely. But I have been on the theme of end of an era for my obsessions, and this is no different. We are sticking to Europe for this obsession, and a couple weeks ago, the greatest song/parade ended, and it was after 2 years of being on, and that is the Disneyland Paris 30th anniversary Dream and Shine Brighter parade. And I feel like we never talked about this song, and it needs to be talked about. It needs to be publicly shared.
It needs to stay.
Because it's amazing, and that is the song Ready for the Ride. We can dream a little bigger right now if we open up our eyes. I'm ready for the ride. Before we went to France, you and I were served every single possible Dream and Shine Brighter parade TikTok. And I have never been so...
So much so that we had our favorite dancers in the parade that we were ready to see.
I had never been so excited to see something ever. And I do think that this does need a backstory of the first time we saw this parade versus, like, the 100%. Next 3 times that we saw this parade. We went to Disneyland Paris, and, like, obviously Disneyland Paris in a whole was on our list, but, like, not gonna lie, this parade was, like, top thing for us to see because we had been served so much content on the internet. And when we were there for the first day, we went to line up for the 11 a.m. parade, and it unfortunately was a day that the cast members were on strike. Yes. And
we support the right.
We do.
Strike.
Disneyland, pay your cast members. That's worldwide. I'm talking. So this parade plays 3 or 4 times a day, I believe. And and so that performance was canceled, and then later in the day there was a performance, and we thought, this is weird, this is not what we saw on the internet, but, like, I guess this is what it is. And we're kind of, like, disappointed. There was just dancers and, like, 2 characters. I'm like, oh,
there were two characters, and the dancers were on the floats waving, and we're like, I don't know why the kids would care about these random people waving.
Exactly.
Them,
okay. And, like, they really only went, like, around the loop and back. One and then time. We ended up meeting these people in line for a ride that were like, oh, this is a pared down version. We saw it yesterday. There was, like, these color fireworks that flew out of the castle. We're like, we don't know what you're talking about. Luckily, we had another day in the park, or another, like,
two more days
in the park.
Two more days.
You better believe that we watched that parade 3 times in one day. And I will say, I've been to Disney many times in my life. This is the second time that we've been to Disney together on a trip.
Yeah.
This was the best show, one of the best parades I've ever seen.
Disneyland Paris has the best entertainment.
Wow, that's a hot take.
No, like the best shows, parades, stuff like that.
The Lion King show was everything at Disneyland Paris. But this specific parade, I remember like reading a tweet about it that was like, there is not a better parade in the world, like in the Disney world, in any country than what's playing in Paris right now. And when we saw it like for real in all of its glory, like I was crying the way that they were like meeting these kids. We were having the time of our lives. And then like for the next 8 days, to which Shara can attest to and probably hates us for it, you better believe we sang Ready for the Ride every day of that trip.
Yes.
And then also if we had a down second in the hotel, we were watching it on YouTube. So end of an era, but that song does exist on Apple Music and on Spotify, so you can definitely go and listen to it.
The whole parade soundtrack
is on Spotify. It's not on Apple. Yeah. But the funniest thing too about that is that after that first day that was the pared down version, we stayed for the fireworks and everyone was singing the other song, Un Monkey Si Lumine. They're like, ooh.
That's from the drone show.
Yes.
Un Monkey Si Lumine is from the drone show.
But it's also in the parade. So we were like, how does everybody know this? Like, I don't understand. It's because it's
By the end of the week we knew it.
It's the theme song to their lives. It was the theme song for the 30th anniversary.
Whoa.
So that's actually a backup obsession, is both of those songs together. Like, you really need to listen to both of them to, like, feel the journey. And also, like, just look up Dream and Shine Brighter on TikTok, and you'll be able to feel the joy that we felt in person at Disneyland Paris. So, end of an era, but a song that will live in my heart forever. And, yeah, that's my obsession of the week. Brings me back. That is our thoughts on In Dreams, and what a way to kick off the new season. We are back in it. We are finally booked for our New York trip, so it's official. I mean, we had play tickets, but we didn't have flights, so it was like officially happening, but now it's officially happening.
We have a way to get there and to get home, which is exciting. Current update is we're seeing Merrily We Roll Along, which people knew, and also The Gatsby at Paper Mill. And then we've got some other show slots to fill still, depending on what's still running and what we're feeling that closer to.
Gatsby at Paper Mill, I think, is going to be interesting. I have thoughts, and they're kind of the thoughts that I thought that I would have, that when I said I think I'd prefer to see the Florence show at ART. But regardless, kind of similar to In Dreams, we will be served vocals, and that's important.
We will be served vocals. Jeremy Jordan, Eva Noblezada, we are coming for you.
Yes.
November 12th.
The final day. That's the final day.
The final day.
Also, night performance. It's also the final day of In Dreams.
It is the final day of November 12th. We will not be here. We will be at In Dreams.
No, we'll be at Great Gatsby.
We'll be at Great Gatsby. And then we'll be flying home that night.
And with that, you can listen to any of our other episodes, as well as you'll be able to listen to all of our upcoming episodes about the new season by subscribing to our podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also watch us on YouTube. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a comment.
And you can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Off2BWayPodcast with number 2.
And TikTok. What's our TikTok handle? I feel like that's actually the true thing that you should follow us at.
Yes, I believe it is Off2Broadway. It has a different handle than the other ones, but I do believe it is Off2Broadway. I'm looking at it right now. It is at Off2Broadway.
We are posting more content on TikTok, so you can follow us
there.
And if you've seen In Dreams, let us know what you think about In Dreams.
Please.
And then also maybe let us know which artist should have a jukebox musical next. Because I feel like that's always the main question.
I know. One day we're going to do an episode where we kind of pitch jukebox musicals to each other, I think.
I feel like we kind of did that on our jukebox or bio musical episode.
Maybe, but like, maybe a different kind. Like, yeah. Anyway.
Agree. And with that, we will see you guys next time.
Bye.